Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. If you read obituaries, you may have noticed that sometimes included in the list of loved ones the deceased left behind are the names of non-human animals left behind. That makes perfect sense. The deceased may have spent more time, may have communicated more with these named animals than some of the humans included in the list. And they may have felt as strong an emotional attachment to their animals as to the humans named, maybe even a stronger emotional attachment. And the animals left behind presumably wonder where their human companion has gone. Are there other creatures besides pets that might miss a person they've relied on seeing on a regular basis? What if every day you feed birds, or squirrels, or deer? Would they notice your absence? In September of 2022, when Queen Elizabeth II died, the papers reported this curious news. The royal beekeeper informed the Queen's bees that the Queen had died. Tradition suggests the royal beekeeper would have knocked on each hive, delivered the news, and perhaps either placed black ribbons tied into bows on the hives or covered each hive in a black mourning cloth for a number of days. According to a superstition that goes back centuries, there's a fear that not informing the bees of the death of their proprietor could lead to a failure to make honey, or the bees might fly out of the hive and never return. Well, this fairly recent event gives us some context for our first poem, John Greenleaf Whittier's Telling the Bees. This is a narrative poem, one that tells a story, and that's today's theme for Poems for Company, narrative poems. Whittier was born in 1807 in Massachusetts in a farmhouse his great-great-grandfather built in the 1600s. As a fifth-generation member of his family growing up in this rural area, he heard folklore tales and stories about witches and ghosts. When he published his poem, Telling the Bees, in 1858 in the Atlantic magazine, he included an introduction that explained the ritual. Whittier presumed even then, in 1858, that this folklore tradition of telling the bees would be unknown to most of his audience. The speaker of the poem returns to Fernside Farm in the present. He recalls that exactly 1 year earlier, he had come to the same farm after a month's absence. At that time, he anticipated meeting again a woman named Mary who lived there, a woman he secretly loved. No one had notified the speaker prior to his visit a year earlier that Mary had died. The poem tells us how he learned of Mary's death. Consider the phrases that open the first four stanzas. Here is the place. There is the house. There are the beehives. A year has gone. The language is straightforward. The manner in which the speaker learns of Mary's death is unique. This is John Greenleaf Whittier's Telling the Bees. Here is the place. Right over the hill runs the path I took. You can see the gap in the old wall still, and the stepping stones in the shallow brook. There is the house, with the gate red barred, and the poplars tall, and the barn's brown length, and the cattle yard, and the white horns tossing above the wall. There are the beehives ranged in the sun, and down by the brink of the brook are her poor flowers, weed o'errun, pansy and daffodil, rose and pink. A year has gone, as the tortoise goes, heavy and slow, and the same rose blows, and the same sun glows, and the same brook sings of a year ago. There's the same sweet clover smell in the breeze, and the June sun warm tangles his wings of fire in the trees, setting, as then, over Fernside Farm. I mind me how with a lover's care from my Sunday coat I brushed off the burrs, and smoothed my hair, and cooled at the brookside my brow and throat. Since we parted, a month had passed, to love a year. Down through the beaches I looked at last, on the little red gate and the well sweep near. I can see it all now, the slantwise rain of light through the leaves, the sundown's blaze on her window pane, the bloom of her roses under the eaves. Just the same as a month before, the house in the trees, the barn's brown gable, the vine by the door, nothing changed but the hives of bees. Before them, under the garden wall, forward and back, went drearily singing the chore girl small, draping each hive with a shred of black. Trembling, I listened. The summer sun had the chill of snow, for I knew she was telling the bees of one gone on the journey we all must go. Then I said to myself, my Mary weeps for the dead today. Haply her blind old grandsire sleeps the fret and the pain of his age away. But her dog whined low. On the doorway sill, with his cane to his chin, the old man sat, and the chore girl still sung to the bees stealing out and in. And the song she was singing ever since in my ear sounds on. Stay at home, pretty bees, fly not hence. Mistress Mary is dead and gone. John Greenleaf Whittier's Telling the Bees. A year earlier, after the speaker had been absent from the farm for a month, the setting looked familiar since his last visit. Just the same as a month before, he says. But then he saw the small chore girl draping the hives in shreds of black cloth. Initially, he presumed it must be Mary's blind old grandsire who died. But then he sees the man sitting by the doorway. Then he overhears the chore girl say to the bees, "Stay at home, pretty bees, fly not hence. Mistress Mary is dead and gone." The bees are informed directly. The speaker, the apparent secret lover, is informed indirectly. How curious. A year later, in the present time of the narrative, he recognizes that by the brook, Mary's pansies and daffodils are now looking poor, weed or run. The speaker does not explain how he has managed his emotions since learning this news. Whittier keeps our focus on the curious manner in which this man in love found out about Mary's death. The gap of a full year allows us to reflect on the speaker's grief, the sadness that lingers. If we presume the speaker's love was kept private, it's likely that his grief is private as well. Does he encounter anyone who comprehends the loss he feels? Is his loss entirely a private matter? Whittier wrote a narrative poem. He tells a story with a plot and includes time references. Or at least we can agree that the outlines of a story are told. The speaker, the silent would-be lover, has been absent for a year from Fernside. His personality and current circumstances are not defined, but at least are strongly suggested. And as we would read in a successful short story, substantial, relevant questions cannot be answered with certainty. Let's hear the poem again, and then consider what Whittier leaves out. John Greenleaf Whittier's Telling the Bees. Here is the place. Right over the hill runs the path I took. You can see the gap in the old wall still, and the stepping stones in the shallow brook. There is the house, with the gate red barred, and the poplars tall, and the barn's brown length, and the cattle yard, and the white horns tossing above the wall. There are the beehives ranged in the sun, and down by the brink of the brook are her poor flowers, weed o'errun, pansy and daffodil, rose and pink. A year has gone, as the tortoise goes, heavy and slow, and the same rose blows, and the same sun glows, and the same brook sings of a year ago. There's the same sweet clover smell in the breeze, and the June sun warm tangles his wings of fire in the trees, setting, as then, over Fernside Farm. I mind me how with a lover's care, from my Sunday coat I brushed off the burrs and smoothed my hair, and cooled at the brookside my brow and throat. Since we parted, a month had passed, to love, a year. Down through the beaches I looked at last on the little red gate and the well sweep near. I can see it all now, the slantwise rain of light through the leaves, the sundown's blaze on her window pane, the bloom of her roses under the eaves. Just the same as a month before, the house and the trees, the barn's brown gable, the vine by the door, nothing changed but the hives of bees. Before them, under the garden wall, forward and back, went drearily singing the chore girl small, draping each hive with a shred of black. Trembling, I listened. The summer sun had the chill of snow, for I knew she was telling the bees of one gone on the journey we all must go. Then I said to myself, my Mary weeps for the dead today. Haply her blind old grandsire sleeps the fret and the pain of his age away. But her dog whined low. On the doorway sill, with his cane to his chin, the old man sat, and the chore girl still sung to the bees, stealing out and in. And the song she was singing ever since in my ear sounds on. Stay at home, pretty bees. Fly not hence. Mistress Mary is dead and gone. Did the speaker ever tell anyone of his love for Mary? Did he abruptly flee the farmyard when he overheard the chore girl tell the bees she was dead? A year later, why does he return to the farm? He says, a year has gone as the tortoise goes, heavy and slow. How has he spent the year since he learned of Mary's death? Whittier writes quatrains, four-line stanzas, with interlaced rhymes. For example, hill, took, still, brook, and care, coat, hair, throat. Most lines end in a monosyllabic word. Each second of four lines is a mere four or five syllables. The other three lines of each quatrain are roughly twice as long. His form is simple and straightforward. The form of the poem does not challenge us. Thus, we may concentrate our attention on the folkloric ritual of telling the bees, a most unfamiliar plot feature, as well as focus on the grief of the man who hoped his love for Mary would grow. The form of today's second narrative poem is also conventional, and I'll say more about that after I read the poem. Edwin Arlington Robinson's Mr. Flood's Party depicts an oddly named man, Eben Flood, who returns home alone by foot from the town located below his house. He speaks aloud to himself. He addresses himself politely, almost formally, and he answers himself. He does not seek pity. The overall narrator of the poem observes him, quotes him, and comments on his circumstances. His friends are no longer living in the town below, and for solitary Mr. Flood, there was not much ahead of him, as the final stanza declares. Comic lines compete with emotionally moving lines in this poem. This is Edwin Arlington Robinson's Mr. Flood's Party. Old Eben Flood, climbing alone one night over the hill between the town below and the forsaken upland hermitage that held as much as he should ever know on earth again of home, paused warily. The rogue was his, with not a native near, and Eben, having leisure, said aloud, for no man else in Tilbury Town to hear, "Well, Mr. Flood, we have the harvest moon again, and we may not have many more. The bird is on the wing, the poet says, and you and I have said it here before. Drink to the bird." He raised up to the light the jug that he had gone so far to fill, and answered huskily, "Well, Mr. Flood, since you propose it, I believe I will." Alone, as if enduring to the end, a valiant armor of scarred hopes outworn, he stood there in the middle of the road, like Roland's ghost winding a silent horn. Below him, in the town among the trees, where friends of other days had honored him, a phantom salutation of the dead rang thinly till old Eben's eyes were dim. Then, as a mother lays her sleeping child down tenderly, fearing it may awake, he set the jug down slowly at his feet with trembling care, knowing that most things break. And only when assured that on firm earth it stood, as the uncertain lives of men assuredly did not, he paced away, and with his hand extended, paused again. "Well, Mr. Flood, we have not met like this in a long time, and many a change has come to both of us, I fear, since last it was we had a drop together. Welcome home!" Convivially returning with himself, again he raised the jug up to the light, and with an acquiescent quaver said, "Well, Mr. Flood, if you insist, I might." "Only a very little, Mr. Flood, for Auld Lang Syne. No more, sir, that will do." So, for the time, apparently it did, and Eben evidently thought so too, for soon, amid the silver loneliness of night, he lifted up his voice and sang, secure, with only two moons listening, until the whole harmonious landscape rang. "For Auld Lang Syne!" The weary throat gave out. The last word wavered, and the song being done, he raised again the jug regretfully and shook his head, and was again alone. There was not much that was ahead of him, and there was nothing in the town below, where strangers would have shut the many doors that many friends had opened long ago. Edwin Arlington Robinson's Mr. Flood's Party. There's at least an outline of a plot here. Mr. Flood's personality and current circumstances are not exactly defined, but at least strongly suggested. Like Telling the Bees, Robinson's poem references a past time that influences what we know about Mr. Flood in the present. He lives in a forsaken upland hermitage, so he's on his own, like a hermit. But there's more. This hermitage held as much as he should ever know on earth again of home. This hermitage is his destination on his night walk home. The poem's narrator informs us he has endured to the end a valiant armor of scarred hopes outworn. Not hopes achieved, but scarred hopes, personal expectations that ran into the realities of his life and now are outworn. In a simile, a direct comparison, this one with very literary overtones, we're told Mr. Flood, standing in the middle of the road that he's following home, is like Roland's ghost winding a silent horn. In the French medieval poem, The Song of Roland, the title figure, Roland, blows his horn on the battlefield at the end of a fight when all his soldiers are dead. There's no one to hear the horn. After blowing it, Roland dies valiantly. More to the point, Roland was defeated because he had been too proud to sound his horn when he needed help. Here, the reference reinforces Mr. Flood's awareness that his friends in the town below are now long gone and suggests he may have failed to reach out to them often enough when they were alive. What might we make of the name of this character, Eben Flood? To say of circumstances that they ebb and flow is simply to acknowledge that, like the tide, there's a rhythm to change, a pattern of decline and fulfillment. Considering all the name choices Mr. Flood's parents faced, they seem to have landed on one with a distinct punning quality, Eben Flood. The poet must have been especially curious about names. The third son in his family, Edwin Arlington Robinson, was unnamed for the first 6 months of his life. Imagine just calling your child the baby or him. Then, strangers at a summer resort put male names on slips of paper, and someone pulled the name Edwin out of a hat. The man who drew the slip was from Arlington, Massachusetts, so that became his middle name, Edwin Arlington Robinson. But I digress. Let's hear the poem once more, Mr. Flood's Party. Old Eben Flood, climbing alone one night over the hill between the town below and the forsaken upland hermitage that held as much as he should ever know on earth again of home, paused wearily. The road was his, with not a native near, and Eben, having leisure, said aloud, for no man else in Tilbury town to hear, "Well, Mr. Flood, we have the harvest moon again, and we may not have many more. The bird is on the wing," the poet says, "and you and I have said it here before. Drink to the bird." He raised up to the light the jug that he had gone so far to fill, and answered huskily, "Well, Mr. Flood, since you propose it, I believe I will." Alone, as if enduring to the end a valiant armor of scarred hopes outworn, he stood there in the middle of the road, like Roland's ghost winding a silent horn. Below him, in the town among the trees, where friends of other days had honored him, a phantom salutation of the dead rang thinly till old Eben's eyes were dim. Then, as a mother lays her sleeping child down tenderly, fearing it may awake, he set the jug down slowly at his feet with trembling care, knowing that most things break, and only when assured that on firm earth it stood, as the uncertain lives of men assuredly did not. He paced away, and with his hand extended, paused again. "Well, Mr. Flood, we have not met like this in a long time, and many a change has come to both of us, I fear, since last it was we had a drop together. Welcome home." Convivially returning with himself, again he raised the jug up to the light, and with an acquiescent quaver said, "Well, Mr. Flood, if you insist, I might." "Only a very little, Mr. Flood, for auld lang syne. No more, sir, that will do." So for the time, apparently it did, and Eben evidently thought so too, for soon, amid the silver loneliness of night, he lifted up his voice and sang, secure, with only two moons listening, until the whole harmonious landscape rang, "For auld lang syne." The weary throat gave out, the last word wavered, and the song being done, he raised again the jug regretfully and shook his head, and was again alone. There was not much that was ahead of him, and there was nothing in the town below where strangers would have shut the many doors that many friends had opened long ago. "He once had many friends," the final words of the poem reveal. Apparently he outlived them all. What was Eben Flood like when in the company of these many friends? We're free to imagine he was supportive of them, even well-liked. Some readers of this poem claim Mr. Flood must be an alcoholic. The poem simply notes he drinks cautiously as he surveys his town after climbing the hill towards home. His thoughts are sad, complex, and cannot be reduced to an easy diagnosis of alcoholism. Future shows will feature more narrative poems. KMUN's podcast page lists all past shows, over 30 of them, and identifies each poem read. Our theme music is Philip Auberg's Going to the Sun from his CD Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company.